Good. Okay, enough donuts. So we're sort of around chapter 3, verse 13, in my sort of meandering way through James in a non-sequential way. So what we're going to do is pick up from where we were just before coffee, and you'll see the bit we're now going to look at, which is going to take us from chapter 3, verse 13, down to about 4:10. Is really explaining how this double-mindedness comes about. How it is the fact that what is inside us that comes out is both blessing and cursing. And what we're going to see is, this passage is going to talk about two wisdoms. So that's the last bit in chapter 3. Wisdom, I think, is James's word for these two worldviews. Two kinds of behaviour, two lists of characteristics. I've just lost. Is this all right? Yeah. We're still okay? Yeah, good. And behind these two wisdoms are two friendships in chapter 4. And the question there whether, at heart, the bottom line is, do we want to be friends with the world or friends with God? Because you can't be both. So that's where we're going in this next little bit then, two wisdoms and two friendships. But first of all, just let me pick it up at chapter 3, verse 13, because the question you might be asking at the end of the bit we've just been looking at in chapter 3 is, well, who then should be our teacher? If James' application of chapter 3, verses 1 to 12 is not many of you, because who should be my teacher? Now, it is interesting that this question here in chapter 3, verse 13, could be exactly that question. So, who is wise and understanding could be who is to be your teacher. And the reason I say that is because there are various places where this little phrase, this little kind of formula, wise and understanding, comes in the Old Testament. And it refers to a leader of God's people. Actually, it's a characteristic of God's true people, but particularly a characteristic for the leader role in God's people, and Moses in particular. It would be nicer for my theory of what's going on in this little bit if it were clearer from the Old Testament that the wise and understanding person is a teacher. But it's not quite as exact as that in the Old Testament. So rather than distort the evidence and say, what chapter 3 verse 13 means is, who then should be my teacher? It's not quite as clear as that. But there is enough, I think, in that phrase, who is wise and understanding among you, to think that the issue is still, okay, well, who can lead us? What should we be looking in for if it's, this is the character, the divided character that we're going to see in all of us. So then, two wisdoms. First of all then, chapter 3, verses 13 to 18. Who is wise and understanding among you? By his good conduct let him show his works in the meekness of wisdom. But if you have bitter jealousy and selfish ambition in your hearts, do not boast and be false to the truth. That's not the wisdom that comes down from above, but is earthly, unspiritual, demonic. For where jealousy and selfish ambition exist, there will be disorder and every vile practice. But the wisdom from above is first pure, then peaceable, gentle, open to reason, full of mercy and good fruits, impartial and sincere. And a harvest of righteousness is sown in peace by those who make seed peace. So first of all, think about a so-called wisdom, what we might call a worldly wisdom. Verse 15 calls it an earthly wisdom. James says it's earthly, unspiritual, demonic. And that wisdom produces the behaviour of bitter jealousy and selfish ambition. Can you see that? Those phrases come in verse 14 and verse 16. And where you've got that worldly wisdom that produces bitter jealousy and selfish ambition, where those things exist, verse 16, everything is disordered. It's a devastating little picture, isn't it? A worldly wisdom that produces bitter jealousy and selfish ambition that leaves everything disordered. A few words, isn't it, but devastating. Now, it's not difficult to see that that is very descriptive of much of our world, isn't it? Most people think that office holders are by definition untrustworthy. Most people would say that Boris, for example, has always been driven by selfish ambition. Sounds like I'm making a political point. I suppose I am making a political point. but I'm not just having a go at the Tories. I mean, that's not my point. It's just that is what drives a successful leader in the world, isn't it? Ambition. And nobody sees it as wrong. It's just him being wily. It's just strategic career planning or whatever. I don't think ambition in verse 14 is seen to be a dirty word, is it? Selfish ambition, maybe, because you're treading on people to get to the top. But and bitter jealousy. I mean, how many Netflix box sets, dramas, TV dramas revolve around that, don't they? Bitter jealousy. Wanting what you haven't got, whether that's somebody else's wife or their prestige or their role. And you don't find it far-fetched to watch a drama, do you? That's all about bitter jealousy. And where it is like that, that everything is going to be disordered. Verse 16, every vile practice. So that's worldly wisdom. And in contrast to that, verse 17, we've got the wisdom that comes from above. Now, interesting, just remember what we were looking at earlier in chapter 1, verse 17. Every good and perfect gift is from above. And we saw particularly that is the word of truth, the implanted word. So that word that comes from above, implanted into a person's life, produces this wisdom that ultimately, therefore, comes from above. And instead of bitter jealousy and selfish ambition, this list that we've got in verse 17, it's very like what we might call work godliness, isn't it? The harvest of the work of God in your life. It's very like what the New Testament elsewhere would call the fruit of the Spirit. What God's Holy Spirit sent from above produces in the life of the Christian. The wisdom from above, or you might say the Spirit sent from above, produces these lovely, attractive characteristics. How? By the word that is implanted. So the Spirit takes the word and implants it into the life of the believer to grow his character. Now you see what James is doing here. He's exposing these two very different wisdoms by showing this dramatic contrast. And I guess the point is compare what results. Compare the end of verse 16 with verse 17. Which wisdom do you find attractive? Which do you want? And if you feel, looking at verse 17, well, this is exactly this kind of godliness that I'd love. This wisdom from above, I agree that is attractive. I really do need heavenly change in me. I need what God's Spirit brings about if I'm going to show the character of verse 17. Well, that wisdom, look back to chapter 1, verse 5. Chapter 1, verse 5 is the very wisdom that we were told to ask for. Now, if you've been in any church, on any church committee or any church council meeting or elders meeting where you are planning meetings, you've got to make a decision together, chances are you've heard chapter 1, verse 5 turned into a prayer at the start of the meeting. Lord, we don't know what to do. Please, will you give us wisdom? Please send us your wisdom from above that we can make a good decision. Now, I don't think chapter 1, verse 5 has anything to do with that. It's not about help to make good decisions in a planning meeting? I think it is if you lack the character that chapter 3 verse 17 describes, then ask for it. Now, of course, incidentally, that is a very good thing to pay at the start of a planning meeting. Lord, give us in this meeting pureness, purity, gentleness, peaceableness. Help us to be open to reason. Those, et cetera, et cetera. Those are good things to pray for a meeting. But I don't think that's normally what people mean when they quote chapter 1, verse 5 in praying for wisdom. But, hey, rehabilitate that prayer. And let's use chapter 1, verse 5 as a prayer for a meeting, but meaning chapter 3, verse 17. And when you ask God for it, he will give generously without begrudging. That's exactly what 1:5 says, doesn't it? He's a good father, and he does give the Holy Spirit to those who ask for him. That's what Jesus said, wasn't it? Father doesn't give a scorpion. The same way, your Father will give the Holy Spirit to those who ask him. He will change you. He will give you this heaven-sent wisdom to replace, to rid you of worldly ways of thinking and behaving. So two wisdoms then, and also, as well as these two wisdoms, two friendships. Chapter 4, verses 1 to 4. What causes quarrels and fights among you? Is it not this, that your passions are at war within you? You desire and you don't have, so you murder. You covet and cannot obtain, so you fight and quarrel. You do not have because you do not ask. You ask, you don't receive because you ask wrongly to spend it on your passions. You adulterous people, do you not know that friendship with the world is enmity with God? Therefore, whoever wishes to be a friend of the world makes himself an enemy of God. So look at that fourth verse there. Two friendships, a friend of the world and a friend of God. And it's quite clear in verse 4, isn't it? You can't be both. It's like Jesus saying you can't serve two masters. You can't serve both God and something else. And James is saying here, verse 4, there are two ways to live, as a friend of the world or as a friend of God, and you must choose. Somebody on the staff did this little animation for you. Watch it, it's fun. Okay, friends of the world, friends with God, and here you are, ready, ready, waiting, waiting. There we go. Cool, right? Do you want to see it again? Here it comes. There we go. Now the point of that is you can't be both. To turn towards one, you have to turn your back on the other. So friendship with the world must entail hatred towards God. And friendship with God must entail enmity with the world. And when somebody becomes a Christian, I think this is the image through this passage, when somebody becomes a Christian, it's like a marriage, that God commits himself to us and us to God, and that's the relationship. So I married my wife Lizzie 42 years and something ago. I know, it's hard to believe. Could he really be that old? Yes, really. And I was asked when we got married, will I, forsaking all others, be faithful to her as long as we both shall live? And I said, yes. And when I became a Christian, I was saying just the same, that God would be my God and I would forsake all others. And James is saying here in verse 4 that to be double-minded, to flirt with the world, that is to break the marriage relationship with God. It is to two-time God. I've never thought about adultery in the sense of planning it, you know, the complex networks of deception that you would need for a successful adultery. I mean, I guess you need to keep your wife and your family happy. You need to appear the dutiful, the apparently faithful husband and father, and you'd refer to the mistress as, oh, she's just some acquaintance, just some at work. And at the same time, you would need to be the passionate lover of the mistress, And you'd be saying to her that the wife, the marriage, the children, all of that's unimportant. So trying to keep both parties happy, thinking and behaving in two contradictory ways at the same time. Now, I hate to mention this. I thought, you know, shall I? Is it too strong for a day like today? Is it inappropriate to do that? And it is a horrible thought. It makes me go cold all over. And I only mention it because that's the image that James uses in verse 4. He calls the Christians that he's writing to adulterous, that they're committing adultery, and that is very strong language. And I presume he does that as a shock tactic, to call it what it is, to call it out for what it is. Now, how then do the first verses fit in, verses 1 to 3? Because when you look down to it, it appears to be saying that there are arguments and fights and quarrels between Christians. And even to the extent, verse 2, that the Christians are murdering one another. Now, you'd think, if in the Tron church things had got so bad that not only were there arguments between Willie and some of the senior elders, but he'd taken out a contract on some of the senior elders, and there are bodies on the stairs being investigated by the police. There is murder at the Tron. You'd think James might have got to that a bit earlier than chapter 4. Saving up the murdering for that point. Actually, a better translation of verse 1 would be, what causes these quarrels and fights within you, what causes them? It's actually exactly the same phrase in the first half of verse 1 and the second half of verse 1. You'll see the first half of verse 1 says, among you, and the second half of verse 1 says, within you. But in both cases, the phrase is, in you. Now, it would be strange, I think, if the first half of the verse were talking about one problem, arguments between Christians, and the second half of the verse changed the subject to talk about a different thing, namely a fight, an internal battle inside you. I think it's much more sensible that the in you should be taken the same way in both halves of the verse. So it could be that the first half of the verse should be understood in the same way as the second half of the verse. Let me say it again. These wars, these quarrels and fights within you, what causes them? Where do they come from? Verse 2, they come from your desires, your passions. That's what's at war within you. Now, you'll recognise that, of course, that war inside. Of course you do. Because of the diagnostic tool of the tongue, of the first half of chapter 3, I know you're a Christian. You've got this conflicting stuff going on inside you. So I know that you recognise this war inside, that on the one hand we covet worldly stuff so much, the kind of desires that we were looking back in chapter 1, verses 14 and 15, being enticed by desires. Desire, when it's conceived, gives birth to sin, and sin, when it's fully grown, brings forth death. You know, it's like we've killed if only we can get our hands on certain things. And on the other hand, we say, don't we, end of chapter 3, that we want this wisdom from above. That we'd like to see more of the fruit of the Spirit in our lives. Maybe we don't actually ask God to give us that. Or if we do, we ask, still keeping a foot in the other camp, hedging our bets, dithering. You know. Yes, please, Lord, make me more godly, but don't include that bit of my life. I'd like to give a little bit of worldly wisdom there, if that's all right with you. I'll have a bit of godliness here and a bit of worldliness there. Can I please live like a Christian and like a non-Christian? And no wonder, verse 3, God doesn't answer that prayer, because we're such adulterers. Do we really think we can two-time God like this and come and ask him for things where we set the limits? Of course not. That'd be daft, wouldn't it? It'd be like dieting and being double-minded about dieting. You know, please can I have a six-pack, and can I have a six-pack of donuts as well? I want to be super trim and super size. So then, summary of what we've seen here in this last bit. Two different wisdoms in chapter 3, different ways of looking at things with different ways of behaving that come from two friendships inside us. As we try to fit in the world, we want to be completely different, as God calls us to be. And we're trying to fit in with everything else. We want to be everybody's friend. We want the best of both worlds. And so we flirt and play the field. Verse 5 is a difficult verse to translate. Or do you suppose it is to no purpose that the scripture says he yearns jealously over the spirit that he's made to dwell in us? The ESV is probably giving us the right idea here. It's a difficult verse to translate, but ESV is good, that God is yearning jealously for us. That being the key idea, that he longs for us. God yearns for us with jealousy. That's how verse 5 brings it out. Now, maybe you find yourself a bit uncomfortable thinking of the idea of God being jealous. I know jealousy is a sin. We've only just mentioned it, haven't we, in verse end of chapter 3, bitter jealousy. Verse 14, verse 16. But think of a husband whose wife is out 3 evenings a week with a lover, doing who knows what. There'd be something very wrong with the marriage, wouldn't there, if the faithful partner felt no jealousy. If he just sat at home and said, "Oh, I don't mind, darling, whatever you like, it's fine, I'll wait for you. I'll wait till you get back. See how you got on. See if you had a good evening." Indifference like that would be terrible, wouldn't it? Any marriage that's a real marriage has got to be exclusive. One man, one woman for life. And it would be the opposite of love, wouldn't it, to say you don't care about it. Jealousy, in other words, shows the husband cares. And I think that's the idea here, that God is yearning jealously, longing with the jealousy of an affronted spouse, if you like. Jealousy over two cut timing shows he cares. He, of course, he's full of anguish and pain. When he catches his wife looking over her shoulder, eyeing up a rival and flirting and two timing, bothers him deeply to see us backsliding like that, being attracted, being seduced by our passions and desires into the arms of so-called wisdom. So he's passionate with longing. He's pleading with us to be rid of the mistress, holding forth his wounded hands and saying, verse 8, draw near. That's what he says to the bride. He wants us back. Come back to be friends with God rather than friends with the world. Well, let's continue then into this next little bit, chapter 4, verses 6 to 10. And following straight on from that, you might want to just chat over what we've just seen about the friendships and the two friendships and the two wisdoms. But looking particularly now at verses 6 to 10, and have a look at the structure of how these verses are put together. And ask the question, I've done this task before and people just talk about the structure. Observe the structure and then say, how does the structure help us to understand what James is here? And then you've got another question as well. What does James tell the double-minded person to do? So into our little groups for a little while to chat about these verses, 4, 6 to 10. Okay, let's have your suggestions for structure, first of all. What do you think is the structure? Not getting any lunch until you give me an answer. Yes.
There seems to be a juxtaposition between proud and humble, devil and God, clean and drawing, being dirty and cleansing, being contaminated and purified, which leads to joy or to bloom.
Okay, good. Thank you, well done. Just want to show you those kind of little pairings that you did, which verses do you think go together? Or you're not quite sure on that bit?
No, I haven't looked.
Okay. Anybody else like to make any suggestion on pairings that there might be here? Anybody spot any pairings?
We draw near to God. He promises to draw near to us.
Yes.
That would be one pair.
Yes.
If we are prepared to know than we.
Yes, good. Yes.
We humble ourselves before the Lord.
He'll exalt us. Yeah, good. Good. Thank you. Any other ideas on pairings?
Yeah.
Yeah.
What are you talking about? 7, 7, 8.
Mm-hmm.
And he says, humble yourself before the Lord. And 10 says, humble yourself before the Lord.
Good.
And he will exalt you.
Yeah, good. Thank you. So 7, A and 10 seem to fit together. Good. Any other things you've spotted? Go on, have a go.
Is the devil leading you in this? Whereas the Lord will draw near to you, will you draw near to him?
So you're saying that 7B and 8A go as a pair? Are you putting those two together? Is that what you just said?
Maybe.
Maybe. I know you don't want to be wrong, but... Good. Well done. Any others? So we've got a 7B, 8A pairing. Any other pairings? If that's not wrong, of course, so don't write it down. So we will study to write it down then. It might be wrong though, right? So don't write it down.
Yeah. Well, submit yourselves to God and resist the devil.
So that's putting 7A and 7B together as a pair. Yeah, good.
Well, 7A and 10A, submit yourselves therefore to God and humble yourselves.
Yeah, good. So that's similar to that. That was your idea. What, 7A and 10 go together? Yeah, which means the 7A and 7B don't fit together quite so well if 7A goes with 10. Any other thoughts?
When God gives grace in verse 6 and God will exalt in verse 10.
Yeah, good. So God gives grace, 6A, God will exalt, 10B. Good. Yes?
I'm attracted by the moral pattern in verse 8. Will draw near to God, he will draw near to you.
Yes, good.
You know, that's affinity.
yeah, good. Good. Any theories that you worked out from spotting whatever structure you spot that you're not willing to share with me? Any theories that you've got from your structure about what the point of the structure is? How that helps us to understand what you think is James's big idea here? Go on, how might that...
Well, it's about the expulsive power of a new affection.
So you can just translate that into expulsive power of what?
Well, either you used to belong to the devil, but rather than belong to him, you belong to God. And everything that you liked, you stop liking, you start liking God. Like, you don't like the world anymore, you like God.
Okay. Yeah, okay. Yeah, thank you. So to see the whole of this bit as unpacking... Okay, right, yes, good. So God yearns and gives grace to help you. Yeah, thank you. Yes?
Is it right that verse 6 and verse 7 establish principles, whereas verse 8 to 10 come after establishing the principle?
Good, so we've got a principle established at the beginning and then some bits that come after the principle?
Which you apply.
Okay, so the application of the principle? Yeah, principle comes first. Thank you. That's helpful. Yeah.
Martin. So I think because you said bookends and pairs, we sort of went all out chiasm. So we've got double mark.
Did you, Martin? Please tell me what you thought.
I think you sort of defeated the idea, so it's wrong.
you're passing the buck. I hear what you. I see what you're doing. Yeah, got it.
So we've got double minded in the middle. And then we're having the purifying of your hearts on one side. That's about repenting in verse 9. Being wretched about our sin. And
yeah.
I want to turn from that.
Yeah.
It's quite beatitudes-like, isn't it? The kind of mourning of sin.
Yeah.
And looking for purity.
Yeah.
And then going at another step, the drawing near to God is... Well, then you're in the bit about... humbling ourselves, which is matched in verse 10.
Yeah, good.
Coming further out.
Yeah.
Something about the picture you gave us of how awful adultery is.
Yes.
Seeing sin like that leads to this kind of repentance.
Yes.
From a double-mindedness.
Yeah, great. That's really helpful. Yeah, thank you. Thank you very much. Yeah, good. So I think the big theme here is to humble yourself before the Lord. I think that's the big idea. So picking up on what Martin said, to see verse 6 and verse 10, that key idea of humbling yourself before him. And I think this is really helpful because, I grew up at the end of a period of the sort of traditional evangelical taboos. You know, as a teenager, for me, worldliness was all to do with watching TV on a Sunday, which we were never allowed to do, drinking, smoking, gambling, visiting the cinema, the six-inch rule. You have to be old enough to know what on earth that is. And it's not that I'm wanting to kind of promote the opposite of those, or to promote those worldly things at all, but of course you can avoid movies and beer parties and still harbour worldly bitterness. And you can be cigarette-free but untruthful, and total abstainers but gossips, modest in dress but acquisitive. So those kind of behavioural concerns, which are not inappropriate, I think if anything we need more taboos, not less, in evangelical circles, but worldliness is something deeper than just traditional taboos. That's my point, I think. And it's all too easy to think. I think this is what I grew up thinking as a teenager, and I've already told you where that got me as a teenager. But I grew up thinking that you stop being worldly by giving up certain things, and largely enjoyable things. That's what I thought, you know, that worldliness was having a good time, and being godly was to stop having a good time, to give up enjoyable worldly things. And you must have been to youth rallies where kind of exposés of sin and worldliness and the calls for all-out commitment and all that. Stand up if you want to declare tonight you're going to be totally committed to Jesus from now on. And I've heard them, you know, I've preached them. But there's none of that here, is there? It's much more subdued, no less passionate, but it is deeper, I think. So James the doctor, who's just told us what wrong is wrong with our tongue, now I think tells us what's wrong in our heart. And of course, the heart speaks what the mouth is full of course. So it makes sense that having talked about what spills out of us through our mouths, he now says what is inside us. And the problem, I think, is pride. And the bookends of these verses help us to see, I think, that that is the root of the problem. And that is, I think, what Dr. James says that worldliness really is. So the second half of verse 6, God opposes the proud. First half, verse 7, submit yourselves therefore to God. Verse 10, humble yourselves before the Lord. That pride is the root cause of all sin. Or to put it another way, it's pride in the heart that leads to the worldly wisdom that we saw at the end of chapter 3, the bitter jealousy and the selfish ambition. And when you think about it, jealousy and ambition, that is all led by pride, isn't it? What makes you bitterly jealous, what makes you selfishly ambitious? Pride, isn't it? You know, the kids talk, what is sin? You spell sin, S-I-N, with the I in the middle, you know. Not everything I learned as a child was wrong. That stuck with me, that's a good one. Meism, that's what sin is. My wife's a teacher, and she went to a day on... this is when we lived in Nottingham before we moved to London 6 years ago. But right at the end of her time there, she went to a day on spirituality. And you probably know that spirituality used to be part of the national curriculum. It's now been replaced by some other trendy term. But it's been notoriously difficult to define. Teachers are supposed to encourage spirituality, and they're all saying, what is it that I'm supposed to encourage? Anyway, she went to this day on spirituality. I think she went there thinking it's probably going to be defined as something like emotional well-being. That seems to be what people mean by it. But it was defined in this day, you won't believe this, as meism. That was the definition that Nottinghamshire Education Department gave to the teachers. It's about me-ism, isn't that incredible? Me at the centre, what I think. You know, that is spirituality. Now that is sin, I think you'll find. And Satan, of course, appeals to our wounded pride. That's his best tactic. That's how he helps to draw us away from a wholehearted submission to God. He plays on our jealousy. He tugs at our ambition and he whispers to us, you're better than this. You deserve more than this. It appeals to our pride. And as we flirt with worldliness, and remember it's desires, that's the thing that is going to be the seed that gets implanted and draws us away to sin and to death. We saw in chapter 1. As we flirt with worldliness, what we're really flirting with is that the chance for self-improvement, for self-elevation, to feel better about the hand that life has dealt us. So no wonder this lover manages to seduce us, because we love all those thoughts. So what does James say that we should do about such pride? And in a word, he says, humble yourself. That's the big idea here, isn't it? There's no bigger blow to my pride than to admit I'm wrong. It's painful, but necessary. We'll always make excuses to let ourselves off the hook. But James is calling us to say, God is in the right and I'm in the wrong. Humble yourself. And I think what he then gives us in between these bookends are three little pairs of what it looks like in practice. So the first one is 7b to 8a. Resist the devil and he'll flee from you. Draw near to God and he'll draw near to you. And that goes back to my clever little animation, doesn't it? You know, turn around. Which means if I'm going that way, I've turned my back on that. So resist, turn your back on, and draw near to, return. And the simple idea, I think, here is return to him. Now, of course, this goes back, doesn't it, to that prayer for wisdom. Yes, Lord, give me your heavenly wisdom. Produce the fruit by the work of your Spirit through your word in my life. Do that, but not this little bit of my life. And we enjoy sin, don't we? So, especially if we can get away with it. Do we really want to turn from it? I remember a long time ago, I was involved with a couple who, she hadn't been married that long, she had an affair, and she was saying to me, you know, I really want to do the right thing. But she blatantly didn't want to. The right thing was to follow her lover, actually, because that was where her heart was leading her. So she said, I want to do the right thing, but she didn't want to. So it's one thing to recognize our sin, it's another thing to be rid of it. And what it means to humble ourselves is to resist the devil and draw near to God. Second thing, 8b to c, cleanse your hands, you sinners, purify your hearts, you double-minded. In other words, get cleaned up. In London, we all have to filter our water because they say that every bit of water that comes out of our tap has already been through seven people. And been gone through cleansing processes and everything. So a bit of rain falling in the Cotswolds, it goes to seven people before it comes out of your tap. So of course we have to filter it. I mentioned about my wife's family living in Eastbourne. They also filter their water. When they filter it, half the beach gets left in the filter. It's so gritty, it's unbelievably gritty. And of course, what you do when you purify something is get rid of anything else that's in it. So you've only got the one thing left. And that is the idea here, isn't it? Purify, you double-minded. Get rid of the other stuff that's making it polluted and dirty and gritty. That pride needs to be sieved out. And it's true both externally, in terms of your hands, in other words, our behaviour, and internally, in terms of our hearts, our attitudes as well. So, Lord, generous Father, passionate lover, please give me that godliness, the wisdom from above that I lack. And then the third bit of what it means to humble yourself is to mourn and weep. Be wretched and mourn and weep. Let your laughter be turned to mourning and your joy to gloom. Hang on, you may say, what about joy? Isn't that supposed to be what it's like as a Christian, to rejoice? I read a little while ago an article about the Puritans in the 17th century. I tried to re-find the article, and I couldn't find it this week when I was looking for it. But the Puritans, of course, have this reputation for being very dour, dressed in black, negative about anything and everything, you know, from mince pies to Christmas or whatever. And this article was basically saying that that popular picture of the Puritans has got it wrong. What the Puritans said was that the Christian life is all about enjoying God, that there is real pleasure to be had in this world through an emotional, ecstatic relationship with God. But it comes from a deep mourning over sin. That mourning over sin and joy in God's great mercy are not opposites, but that they go together. In fact, the more that I grieve over my sin, as verse 9 describes it, the more deeply I'll be moved that God could ever love me. Bowled over that God should be my passionate, committed, faithful husband. So it's not that laughter and joy are wrong in themselves, I think, but rather that the Christian life is not a carefree barn dance where we're just skipping around gaily. Grief, mourning, wailing, gloom should mark my Christian life just as much as inexpressible and glorious joy. So the big call then here is to humble yourself before the Lord. And that's God's call to those of us, verse 5, that he yearns jealously over, to draw back to himself. Now, all the way through this bit, we've been going through chapter 3 and halfway through chapter 4, I've really been emphasising this theme of double-mindedness all the way through. Because I want us to hear the melodic line and to hear it clearly through James. And one of the reasons I think it's so helpful to get this clear is that there are things you, when you've got the melodic line of a book clear, there are things you start noticing that you think, oh, that's really significant. Let me show you an example here. So there is a snatch here of a theme that gets mentioned at the end of chapter 2. Look back to the end of chapter 2, talking about Abraham. We're going to come to this passage probably this afternoon. But you'll see, Abraham believed God. It was counted to him as righteousness, and he was called a friend of God. Now, notice chapter 4, verse 4, this same idea of friendship with the world and enmity with God, or friendship with God and enmity with the world. So being a friend of God is the metaphor to describe pure and undefiled religion, I think. Comes just twice in James, but it's significant. It's significant because it's used to describe Abraham, who's going to be given us in chapter 2 as an example of the kind of spirituality, true biblical religion that is being held up to us in this letter. And it's right at the heart of this metaphor of double-mindedness, who you're the friend to. And Abraham, and for that matter, Rahab as well at the end of chapter 2, are being held up as examples of friends of God. They are people who were not double-minded. Now, here's the thing. I've got 10 commentaries on James on my bookshelf. Of those 10, 8 of them make no comment about this word appearing in the two places. 8 of them don't even mention it. So they hear no common melody between Abraham being described as a friend of God and that idea of friendship with God, friendship with the world in chapter 4, verse 4. Number 9 of my 10 commentaries notes the similar language, but think they've probably got nothing to do with each other. The 10th agrees that there is a link and suggests, just in passing, that Abraham is probably the supreme example of chapter 4, verse 4. But then this 10th commentary gives 4 times as much space to link to phrases in intertestamental literature, or there's writing that comes between the Old and the New Testament. Now, this is the kind of thing that drives me crazy about drives me crazy about commentaries. What do you go to a commentary for? They don't notice that and talk about it. If double-mindedness is a central idea, if the danger for the wandering Christian is the lure and pull and desires of the world pulling you to be a friend of the world, and if the call of the letter is to stop being a friend of the world and to be a faithful, loyal friend of God, and if Abraham is described as called a friend of God, a phrase that James inserts when he's quoting from Genesis chapter 15, surely that phrase in chapter 2, verse 23 is big, isn't it? It can't be coincidental. I mean, James, by adding that phrase just after quoting from Genesis 15, is making that link to say, you know this bit in Genesis 15? What that means is, dot, 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 he was called a friend of God. Get it? Get it? And my 10 commentaries are saying, no, don't get it. What? And if we've got any antennae for the tune of the book, then surely when we get to 223, we hear this phrase as a snatch of something bigger. That what Abraham did, the faith of Abraham, is a model for the Christian who might be led astray. Abraham is showing us the faith that saves, how to save my soul, how the implanted word, the gospel word, produces the righteousness of God, showing how to be a friend of God. In other words, you could say that one of the ways of summarizing the message of the book of James is do an Abraham. Don't be a double-minded, two-timing adulterer, but do an Abraham. Anyway, rant over. Good. So we're going to go back now to chapter 2. There is a kind of logic to the way we're going through the book. But let's just pause at that point. Anybody want to ask questions, make comments about that central section in particular, chapter 3 through to 4:12? Anything on any of that? Anybody wants to say, ask a question about? You're not going to, because I've now made you so nervous you might say the wrong thing. Nobody's going to risk it.
Do you think there's anything in, when you were talking about links to the Old Testament, do you think there's anything in the bit of the blessings and curses?
Yes.
Blessing and cursing, and then the other bit.
Yes, I do, but you're going to go on, say more. What do you think the link might be? So you're thinking about from the same mouth come blessing and cursing. So might that link back to, I presume you mean...
Blessing back in the law, blessing.
Yes.
And also the bit earlier on where it talks about the sun and the grass. You know, the sun rises, it's scorching, it withers the grass, it's flower falls, and it perishes. So will the rich man fade away. That's, you can't hear that, but think about the word of the Lord.
That's right. Yes, that's right. And also many places in the Old Testament that aren't immediately jumping into my head, but that speak about fading away and being like the grass. And
there's the contrast right there from the beginning, from blessing and cursing.
Yes.
What will last and what will fade away.
Yes, yes.
Abraham's a friend.
Yes. Yeah, good. Thank you. Yeah, good. I think the answer to the question, do you see any link there between this and something in the Old Testament, is nearly always going to be yes. The question, I think, is what you do with that link. In other words, how big it is. And that requires kind of more work on the text to be sure the degree to which you can say, see, that shows. I mean, what does it show and how does it help us? But yeah, I absolutely agree. Those kind of echoes, there are lots like that. Thank you.
It's interesting that, you know, draw near to God and he will draw near to you is like a great calendar verse that people put everywhere. And it kind of, you know, with a beautiful sunset and rolling hills, and everyone thinks, oh, I just need to feel a bit closer to God and it'll go well. But in context, it's actually really hard work.
Yes.
Draw near to God.
Yes. And it is a massive verse of humble yourself and repentance. Very striking, isn't it? What it means to draw near to God is not kind of go for a walk in the countryside and look at a sunset. It means to turn from sin, turn from double-mindedness, to humble myself before him. Yeah, thanks.
At the beginning, you were talking about the relationship or not relationship with wisdom and literature, but the resonance for me, you talk about one of the big things here being humble yourself before the Lord. And then thinking about the wisdom literature, the fear of the Lord being the beginning of wisdom.
Yes, yes.
And for me, that
yes. Is there any
really big theme of how we orientate our lives? It's either with the fear of the Lord,
yes,
and therefore mourning our sin,
yeah,
and rejoicing in, yeah, forgiveness.
Does James use the idea of the fear of the Lord? So the wisdom idea is there, but is that linked to the fear of the Lord there? That would be interesting to pursue. We might come on to that this afternoon. Amy?
Can I ask an application question? Kind of. Just, I suppose, thinking about your role at Cornhill as we train young people to be...
Not many. I'm making it smaller.
About 3 verse 17 that I found very striking over the last couple of years. How does that land for you at Cornhill? How do we train people while helping them be peaceable, open,
yeah,
to reason,
yeah,
those kind of things? Is that,
yeah,
what you thought about?
Yeah, it's interesting. I mean, as you know, the kind of English evangelicalism, I don't know the degree to which it's really impacted on here, but we've been rocked by a number of high-profile scandals, and particularly involving abusive leadership. And some of them have come quite close to us and our organisation. And it's produced a lot of really it's produced a lot of awful Twitter stuff, but it's produced a lot of really helpful heart-searching and thinking through issues of character a lot. Certainly for us, in our training, we've done a lot of thinking about how do you grow character in somebody. And, you know, do you have a session on anger? You make everybody really angry and then say, you've got to learn to deal with that. you know, what's your method of growing character? And I think the bottom line for us is, yeah, we carry on doing what we're doing, because actually we think the Bible, through the work of His Spirit taking His word, it is the word that will train in righteousness. So it not only teaches and rebukes and corrects, but also trains in righteousness. So what is going to produce righteous behavior? It is actually getting people sitting under the Bible being taught, getting it into their hearts and minds. Now, obviously, it's a bit more complex than that, because the scandals that have rocked us, those who were in high profile positions, it wasn't that they had a reputation for being weak on exegesis. Actually, they were strong. Their reputation was for being excellent expositors. But something obviously had gone wrong, that somehow the word was not, there was a blockage between the word that they were speaking and the training in righteousness in their heart. And I think James really helps with this, that I think, you know, this whole idea of the word being implanted and that implanted word producing life, and yet the world and its desires being implanted and giving birth to sin and sin to death. That there is that, this whole James thing, I think, of the double-mindedness. And I take it that we have to look back to those people and say, yeah, the word was somehow blocked and worldly desires took over. And what we saw, in fact, was bitter jealousy, selfish ambition, disorder, vile practice, and a pride. Yeah. But that shouldn't remove from us the confidence that what actually is going to train the next generation of gospel workers is the word implanted in them. It will train them in righteousness. Yeah. Yes?
Is there any sense where we say everything is perfect yet comes from the Father? But that is also seen in the context of the trials and temptations that He ordains. Well, He's not the author of evil, nonetheless He ordains trials and temptations, and that they are part of the everything is perfect gift.
I understand your question. I'm hesitating because I don't deny the truth of that. I think that is true. I'm not sure whether that is what James is saying. We may or may not have time to get onto that this afternoon. I certainly believe the theological truth that you're articulating. I'm not sure whether in James the idea of the trial of the temptation is basically a fork in the road. And we face it again and again. It's not so much trial. It's not trials meaning opposition for being a Christian. I don't think it's specifically temptations in verse 13, but I think the trial is, here in this situation, will I be a friend of the world or a friend of God? How will I react to this? And it has the potential, that trial, to become a temptation to pursue the desires that lead to sin and death. And I don't think that James says that that process is something that God initiates. But verses chapter 1, verse 12, 13, 14, and so on is tricky, which we might get onto. Okay, let's move up to chapter 2 now. And chapter 2, what we've got here, I think, is an example to make the point. So end of chapter 1, you'll see it picks up exactly that idea of purity versus pollution. If anybody thinks he's religious and doesn't bridle his tongue but deceives his heart, this religion's person's religion is worthless. Religion that is, notice this, pure and undefiled before God the Father is this: to visit orphans and widows in their affliction and to keep oneself unstained from the world. So you've got this repeated idea of purity, undefiled, unstained. You've got the idea of the water filter there. That true religion is has been through the filter, has been water filtered. All the impurities have taken out. And chapter 2, I think, gives us a first example of pollution, of how worldly thinking can stain and defile us. So I've called chapter 2 an example of double-mindedness. And you'll see we're on page 4 now in the handout. I own a free-sitting pew. You may not know what that is, but a church in London was getting rid of them. They're sometimes known as a poor pew. And until the early mid-20th century, it was a common practice in churches in England to rent pews. So a family or an individual would pay money to the church warden to rent the pew as their family pew. And it was a way of raising income, of course, because it meant that the church warden had regular income from people who were renting pews from him. And many of these were box pews, of course. Oh, sorry, let me just flick through these. Many of these were box pews that had a door that could be padlocked. So you could say, that's our pew. You had the key, so you could get in. And of course, what he did was enforce a sort of social status in church seating, because only those who could afford it would have one. And everybody knew who had enough money to be able to afford a box pew. And pew rental became a source of controversy in the 1840s, 1850s. There was all kinds of debates. There was parliamentary legislation about pews in the 1850s. Now, during the time of these rented pews, poor people had bare benches provided for them, which were poor pews, of which I have one. And the idea was they were somewhere at the back or down the side where poor people could perch without needing to pay money to be in church. They didn't have to pay rent. Now, I begin this way because as we read James 2, and it seems a bit of an odd scenario, the link between pennies and pews is not as strange as we may think. And what we've got here is a situation where two visitors have come to church, or literally, verse 2, into your synagogue. They're not regulars because they don't know where to sit. And of these two people, one is the kind of person that we all fawn over, and the other person is the kind of a bit of an embarrassment. So if you had the choice of a premier cinema chair, you know, the kind of big wide one with the place to put your drinks and your popcorn, the massive chairs, or one of my poor pews, you know who would get which seat. So one smells of money and the other just smells. You've got the banker, the beggar, the entrepreneur, the economic migrant. And that's what the example at the beginning of chapter 2 is all about. What will you do as these two guests come into church? Look at chapter 2, verse 1. It's the story of somebody who has the faith in our Lord Jesus Christ with partiality. And as you read that, we're probably thinking in our minds, what's so surprising about partiality? To which the answer is, well, nothing. Because the world shows partiality all the time, doesn't it? Of course the world treats some people as better than others. Before we moved to London, when we were living in Nottingham, we lived in an old farmhouse for about the last 8 or 9 years. It's a very shabby sort of farmhouse. It's wonderful, but it's quite shabby. Anyway, it had an arger. It's the thing you need to know. We never had an arger before. And we'd never been to an arger shop, therefore, because we'd never had an arger. If you've never been into an arger shop, let me tell you, arger shop people are very snooty. We went into one when we were on holiday. We were just wearing our holiday togs, you know, sort of shorts, flip-flops, all the rest. And they looked, the people who were working in the Argus shop took one look at us and were very dismissive. They obviously kind of assessed us. These are not Argus people. These are people just on holiday with pretensions of grandeur, you know. So they were very dismissive of us. That same summer, a few months later, we were on our way to a wedding and we were dressed up to the nines in our wedding garb. And we got a bit of time to kill between the reception, between the wedding itself and the reception. And we drove through a village, which again had an arg shop, different one. And we went in there, dressed very differently. And let me tell you that we were treated completely differently, wearing our wedding garb from wearing our holiday garb. Now, of course, the world shows partiality on the basis of all kinds of things. Class, your accent, what school you went to. Your skin colour, as we've come to see so terribly in the last few years. Your job, your profession, oh, he's just a such and such. Your possessions, I can't believe you've still got an iPhone 8. How attractive a personality you are. Your looks, your weight, your body shape, your clothes, you know, the list goes on and on, doesn't it? The basis on which we discriminate, in the sense that we draw certain conclusions about people and treat people differently on the basis of those things. And the list, you know, is encouraged by things like magazines and adverts and chat shows and passing comments outside a supermarket. And we pick up on this checklist of what makes somebody cool and what makes somebody uncool. And you've got to buy into this list and agree with everybody else if you want to be part of their gang. And that is the backdrop, I think, to this scenario here in James chapter 2. Back at church, it's next Sunday. I'm not even aware that I've got all this in my head. Not aware that I've spent all week looking up, looking down, and imbibing the world's pecking order. Here, based on economic position. I am a real Christian, verse 1. I do hold the faith in our Lord Jesus Christ, the Lord of glory. But when verse 2 happens and these two visitors walk in the back door, all my innate worldly thinking comes to the fore. And I show partiality, favoritism. I treat some people as better than others. Now, for us, it may or may not be showing people to their seats. I don't know whether your church is the kind of church that shows people to their seat. Our church is not. Not at all. But we definitely have ways, don't we, of showing the kind of person we prefer. Imagine a famous person came to your church, and somebody who you didn't know who they were, but it's their first time in church. Which one of the two would you text your friends about? You'll never guess who was in church this morning. There we are. Makes the point, doesn't it? The person at the end of church in the coffee melee, the coffee cocktail party, you know, the person that you will linger around in the hope that you might get a chance to chat to them, and the person who you definitely avoid and walk around the other way to go and get your coffee because you don't want to get caught with so-and-so. Now, of course, if you ask me, I'll say everybody's just as important, the gospel's for all, it makes no difference. Skin, colour, or gender, or class. You know, Jesus, God shows no partiality. Jesus died for all. And that is the point, you see. I still firmly believe the Christian stuff. Whilst at the same time, inconsistently, I do some of that verses 2 and 3 stuff. And the thing is that my Christian faith, verse 1, holding the faith in the Lord Jesus Christ, has not worked its way all the way through. And when we're like that, verse 4, have you not made distinctions among yourselves? Or literally, again, have you not become divided within yourself? Interesting again how that verse can be translated. In other words, being Christian and being worldly, divided within yourself. In other words, have you not been double-minded, which is James's big theme? Living as a Christian and as a non-Christian, trying to be friends with the world and friends with God. Or verse 4, have you not become judges with evil thoughts? In other words, worldly thoughts. Worldly thinking, that's making me judge people and show partiality, even when I'm a Christian and I know it's wrong. And the answer is, yes, we have, and yes, we do. And James is saying, again, quite simply, cleanse your thinking. Receive again the implanted word, the true truths of what God tells us that's able to save your souls. Be Christian in this and show no partiality. So James is, if you like, is all about the consistent Christian, what we believe and what shows match. You might think that the concern is hypocrisy. That thing that the world finds so repugnant in the religious, doesn't it? You know, the vicar caught with his trousers down or whatever. We say one thing, but we fall far short of doing it. But I want you to see that's not quite the issue here in chapter 2. See, the thing that is being done by Christians is not repugnant to the world, but utterly respectable to the world. Showing partiality is exactly what the world thinks you should do, and does do. And it's copying the world, that's the issue, rather than displaying our Christianity. And in the rest of this chapter, James is going to explain why this kind of thinking is a problem, which we will look at this afternoon, because I notice our morning has gone. That is right, isn't it? It is 12:30, we've stopped, isn't it? Yeah, that is. It is 12:30, we stop, isn't it?
Yes.
Yeah, okay. So let's pause there. So we'll pick up after lunch with what it is that is wrong with this kind of partiality that James is exposing in this example of double